Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, a producer and host with KCPW, and before we turn to the topics we'll address on this program today, I'd like to make a quick statement about Jennifer Napier Pierce, who hosted this program for nearly 3 years. Jennifer's moving to the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah to be their director of communications, and although I've been tapped as the new host of this program, it would be ridiculous to pretend to be Jennifer's replacement. This program, Behind the Headlines, is her brainchild and represents a key piece of a great partnership spanning the print and radio worlds that Jennifer moves between very fluidly. And in addition to her broadcast and reporting abilities, I should say that she is the reason that I am in public radio at all myself. I got my feet wet in this medium doing a history segment here on KCPW under Jennifer's watchful eye years ago, and years later she helped me break back into radio news reporting. Anyway, the point of all of this is to say, Jen, if you are listening, my personal thanks and the thanks of many listeners who, like me, appreciate what you accomplished with this program and with much more than that. And we wish you all the best in your new position. And as I said, you're listening to Behind the Headlines. Today on the program, the state of Utah joins others in suing the federal government over a presidential directive that asks U.S. schools to let transgender students use bathrooms that match their gender identity. Also, a Tea Party endorsement in the governor's race. The Utah Transit Authority reverses course on closed-door meetings, Paul Huntsman's plans for the Tribune, and probably a few more items from this past week's news. And I'm joined in the studio this morning by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Yeah. Also, health, education, and environment reporter Emma Penrod. Emma, thanks as well for being here.
Morning. Good to be here.
Government and politics reporter Lee Davidson is here in studio, too. Lee, good morning.
Hi.
And columnist Paul Raleigh is also with us today. Greetings, Paul, and welcome.
Good morning.
And listeners, you can join us to comment. You can join us to comment on these or any topics that caught your attention this week. Tweet your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk or put them in the comments section at sltrib.com. You can also call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Where to begin? I'm drawn to the fact that I've got several Salt Lake Tribune reporters here and some Salt Lake Tribune news to discuss. Paul Huntsman, who announced back in April that he was purchasing the newspaper, made an appearance in the Tribune newsroom, and he talked a bit about the timeline for the completion of his purchase of the paper and maybe a little bit about what the future might hold. Paul Raleigh, what did Huntsman have to say in his visit yesterday to the Tribune?
Well, it was all optimistic. I will say he's got a very good taste in barbecue. He brought in lunch for us. It was a very pleasant meeting. He brought his father with him, John Sr., the patriarch of that family. And John Sr. Had made some remarks and made it very clear that that Paul will be is the owner of the Tribune, and he's going to be the one calling the shots with probably advice from his father. They talked about Paul owning the paper for a while and then eventually turning it over to his son, Paul Jr. So it was all optimistic. We all, you know, I think most of us felt pretty good about it. And so I think we have a sunny look for the future.
I'm tempted to take a poll of Tribune reporters here, but I understand that he'll take over as publisher, but he's going to retain Terry Orme as the current, who's the current editor of the
That's
Tribune.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, and it was John Huntsman Sr. who tried to quash any concerns that he or his family might make the Tribune an organ of either the Republican Party or the Mormon Church.
Yeah, he did make that clear that there's no agenda, and he basically said that they don't plan on interfering much with the what we do in the newsroom, and they seem to be very pleased with the direction that we've gone in the newsroom over the past few years under Terry Orme's leadership. And I mean, I got the impression that he was saying that they're basically going to keep, you know, let us alone and let us keep doing what we're doing.
This is great news because I've been spent the last 6 months on a John Huntsman Sr. expose that is going to be coming out soon.
Robert Gerke. So this deal is going to be finalized next week. June 1st is what we think. Do we know any of the details of the deal? I know that there were a number of things that needed to be worked out, a Department of Justice investigation. There was a lawsuit by former Tribune employees. That investigation was into the joint operating agreement between the Tribune and the Deseret News. Do we have any of that information yet?
Robert? No, not yet. Paul said that he's not going to comment on any of the specifics of the deal until it's closed on Tuesday, I believe, is what he's looking at. He said he wants to, you know, he's confident it'll go through pending approval from, as he put it, the legal entities involved. I think there's sort of an assumption that the revenue split that John Huntsman Sr. referred to yesterday as the fiasco of 2013 will probably have to be revised in some way, because that's one of the big sticking points for the group that's suing to block it, and also one of the things the Justice Department was looking at. So there's an assumption, I think, that'll have to be reworked somehow. But he said he's going to be coming back after the deal closes and giving us some of the specifics on the deal, but he wasn't really taking questions yesterday.
Neither about that or what kind of changes he might implement at the Tribune.
Well, one of the things Terry said yesterday, told our reporter yesterday, is that, you know, in the coming weeks they plan to sit down and kind of identify areas that they feel like the paper maybe has slipped in the last several years, you know, since we've been running on a shoestring budget, and you know, try to bolster those. And I think John Sr. said yesterday that he that there is a commitment to sort of invest some money in bringing it back, I think, as he put it, to the Tribune of old, you know, and so that's, I mean, you know, speaking as a reporter there who's kind of been through sort of the decline, it's great news. I mean, it's exactly what you want to hear. Now we just kind of have to wait and see how they execute.
You know, one thing I'm wondering if we'll ever know is how much money exchanged hands in this deal. Can we know that? Is that something that will come out? Anybody?
I suspect it'll come out one way or another. We'll get. You know, we're a bunch of reporters reporting on the news. I think we're going to probably find somebody who will tell us that. But we don't know how much it is yet. I think if I remember right, there was talk at about $16 million was sort of the going, you know, the estimated value of it. I don't know what they negotiated, but that's sort of the ballpark, I think.
Okay, well, a Tribune out of the hands of a distant hedge fund and into the hands of a well-known Utah family, and I guess just waiting for the ink to dry now. Okay, we've got the news about the news out of the way. Let's move on to some other topics from this past week. Robert Gerke, I'm going to stick with you. On Wednesday, the state of Utah said it was joining onto a lawsuit along with a number of other states challenging a directive by the Obama administration. This all sounds kind of familiar, and it has to do with U.S. schools, gender identity, and bathrooms. What was this all about?
So back in earlier this month, let's step back a little bit. North Carolina, earlier this year, passed a law that says that children in schools have to use the bathroom that it corresponds to their biological, their birth gender, essentially. Essentially saying that transgender students have to use the bathroom of their biological gender. And the Obama administration came in and said that, you know, this is not legal. They filed a lawsuit against it. They also issued a memo to states across the country saying, they called it a Dear Colleague letter, saying, you know, under the Civil Rights Act, under Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, we have to, you have to make accommodations for children who are, you know, for their identified gender, or the gender in which they identify with. And so this obviously has become a political hot button issue in an election year, and everybody's seizing on it, on both sides. Texas, On Wednesday, the attorney general out there filed a lawsuit. 11 states in all joined. Utah was one of them. Attorney General Reyes jumped on board. Attorney General Reyes says that this isn't about children. This isn't about gender identity. This is about the federal government telling the state what it can and can't do. Governor Herbert said that, you know, this is a one-size-fits-all solution from the federal government, and it doesn't work. It should be left to local school districts and parents and teachers to work through these issues. And there's also this sort of implied threat, I guess, of loss of federal funds for education if they don't comply with it. So that's the state's argument is that all 11 states are arguing that, you know, this is not something that the federal government should have purview over, that this should be left to the states and local communities to sort of work through these issues. And so that's how the lawsuit's teed up right now.
But so the argument being more about federal overreach than about the directive, what the directive actually says itself. Is that, I mean...
Well, the law, the way the law is written, it says that, you know, you have to make accommodations for the sex of the student, there's a disagreement on whether, you know, the Obama administration's interpreting sex to include gender identity. Texas is saying that that's not the way the law was written and way it was intended. So there's a dispute over that as well. And I think they said that this is the Obama administration is trying to make this make schools a laboratory for a social experiment, and would require seismic changes, as they put it, to accommodate these issues. And so that's what we're working at. Now, to be fair, put this in context, I guess, schools have been dealing with these issues for a long time without direction from the federal government. I think the actions by North Carolina and some other states have kind of made this issue that was, maybe not a national political, hot button issue, made it sort of a front burner issue. And also, obviously now it's become an election year presidential political issue. And also, at the state level, we've seen Governor Herbert and Jonathan Johnson both weigh in on this, as they campaign for governor.
So is that the reason? Maybe Paul Raleigh, I'll put this question to you. Is election year politics playing a big hand in maybe in both the response by the states, but conceivably even by, I'll leave it in your court. Is this election year politics at work?
Well, let me just say, if you're a Republican in Utah, you sue the Obama administration. That's a natural law. The whole idea of federal overreach, that's become very popular in conservative circles. It's interesting that when they talk about the threat of withholding federal funding and that sort of thing, I mean, that's federal funding has been attached to conditions in all sorts of areas to states over the years. There's nothing new there. But no, it is election year politics. I mean, I think with Sean Reyes up for re-election, the governor having a primary fight, fighting against a guy to the right, kind of a Tea Party guy, and the whole idea is states' rights versus federal government. That's very popular among the conservative circles in Utah. I mean, we're suing or we're getting ready to sue the federal government over public lands. That's a conservative rallying cry. Like Robert mentioned, though, it's interesting, and you see this all the time, a disconnect between, some the politicians who are holding office now and needing to shore up their conservative credentials, and basically the general public, or in this case, school districts who have said that we had a story the other day by Benjamin Wood that's not a big deal to them. But the politicians are the ones who have to make it a big deal.
Well, in his monthly news conference, Governor Gary Herbert addressed, this is actually before this the fact that Utah had signed on to this lawsuit came out. He expressed the idea that letting transgender students use non-private bathrooms might lead to bullying. And we actually have a clip of Governor Herbert and what he had to say.
What I would want to have happen is, in fact, if somebody's forced to use a bathroom that is not private and ends up exacerbating the bullying problem that they have that they're trying to get away from anyway. Again, that's why I expect that the local communities will have a better handle, a better grasp for what's in the best interest of their students when it comes to privacy, dignity, safety for all the students.
And so, I mean, what Governor Herbert's saying there is going again a little bit beyond the complaint about presidential overreach. This is about sort of local issues, and this is, I guess, something you were just addressing, Paul Raleigh. Meanwhile, LGBT advocates say this is about fundamental human rights and access to the same services that everybody else has. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Troy Williams from Equality Utah said in response to this that, you know, that we're turning these children, I guess, into a political football, right? I mean, these kids they just want to be kids, right? And now we're kind of thrusting them into this crossfire between these competing political interests rather than putting, you know, consideration on their well-being and their own interests. And so, you know, and Governor Herbert was kind of touching on that, I think, that you know, you're putting a target on him almost by making this an issue when maybe it wasn't an issue before. And it could exacerbate bullying, he said. And so ultimately, I think, you know, the goal, both from what Governor Herbert was saying and from what Troy Williams from Equality Utah was saying, was let's think about the kids first and scoring political points second. Unfortunately, with an election looming, the political points become worth a lot more than children sometimes.
And the state signs on to a lawsuit. Well, I guess politics plays a hand. We'll have to leave it there until we see some action in the courts. And we don't know exactly how this will play out. There will be some sort of court battle.
Yeah, the administration will respond to it. And I think their argument has already been pretty well laid out. There is some precedent, I think, on their side. And so, but let's, you know, it'll take months. We won't see a resolution to this for several months.
Okay. Robert Gerke, thanks for your reporting. Right now, we're going to have to take a quick break here on Behind the Headlines. Listeners, you can tweet your comments to the hashtag TribTalk, comment at sltrib.com, or call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 355-8255 to join this conversation. We'll take a short break and return in a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
What is Utah culture?
What is Utah culture?
Whether it's hiking in Red Rock Country, listening to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, camping in a national park, drinking a 3-2 beer at a Twilight concert series show, or jeeping in Moab, we want to know what you think Utah culture is. Join the conversation now at upr.org.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. The star changes every night, doesn't know the plot, receives an envelope when they walk on stage, and the show goes on. Next time on Cue, I'll speak with an actor about to enter the mysterious world of Broadway's White Rabbit, Red Rabbit. That's coming up on Cue from PRI, Public Radio International. Today at 1, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by a great team from the Salt Lake Tribune, Lee Davidson, Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, and Paul Raleigh. And we're looking at the week's top headlines in review. Again, you can join the conversation using the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter, commenting at sltrib.com, or calling us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. I asked a little bit of a politics question before we went to the break, and I'll stay in the political realm for a moment here. Yesterday, we learned that Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, after meeting with Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland, did not have his mind changed and continued to believe that the Senate should wait to consider any nomination until after the presidential election. The only problem is that we learned this before Senator Hatch actually met with Garland, which he did do yesterday evening eventually. I'm not certain who to turn to here, but Robert Gerke, Paul Raleigh, maybe staying with the two of you for a moment. Can you address what happened here? Paul, do you want to take a shot at it?
Well, yeah, I actually talked to Orrin Hatch's communications director yesterday, who was very defensive about the whole thing. And basically, they're laying all the blame on the Deseret News, and the editor of the Deseret News actually came out with a statement apologizing for putting that op-ed online prematurely. The question is that he basically said, and he said it in past tense, he said, you know, after meeting with Garland, that he was it didn't change his mind. Well, he hadn't met with Garland, but what they said, their take is that it was just a draft op-ed, and it was subject to change after he met with Garland, and they just put it out prematurely, and so it was all the Deseret News' fault.
Well, in the Deseret News, yeah, as you said, they apologized to Senator Hatch and said it was an unfortunate error and that this was a draft form. This got a lot of national attention as well. Robert Gerke.
Right. The Washington Press Corps and groups that have been advocating for Judge Garland's confirmation or at least a hearing on his confirmation seized on it as proof that there's not an open mind on the Judiciary Committee and Senator Hatch, who's probably I believe the senior member, I guess Chuck Grassley maybe is still a senior member, you know, is indicative of that they've already made up their minds and they can't be swayed and they're not going to change. The statement from the Deseret News is notwithstanding. I mean, the draft. It almost makes it worse because the draft was written well in advance then of the meeting, not just something that not just an oops, right? The die was cast, and and if you put yourself in Judge Garland's shoes, you're walking into a meeting where the person you're meeting with has already said no, I'm not going to change my mind no matter what you say. You know, it's almost comical, I guess,
Entrenched positions, I mean, is what it, I guess, demonstrates some politically entrenched positions. Paul, go ahead.
Well, I believe Senator Hatch has been twisting himself in knots over this issue all over the place. He in the past had great praise for Judge Garland, who was, easily confirmed before when he was up for a judgeship. And then Senator Hatch praised him quite a bit before. And then he also said fairly recently that Obama should pick somebody like Garland, but he won't because he'll pick a liberal. And that was part of his reasoning for holding on. Well, then he picked Garland. And then he had the kind of – now his argument is we have such a contentious election that it wouldn't be fair to Garland. And, I mean, you know, it just seems to be that he's – to me that he's – the more he goes on with this argument, the more disingenuous he seems to be. And I think that the problem is they don't want to have a hearing with Garland because he will be, you know, impressive. And then what do? Do they vote against a guy who's a pretty moderate guy?
You can imagine after an election, Hatch once again endorsing Garland, maybe depending on the outcome of the election. Does it look like we're going to have to wait for this election before we have a confirmation process?
Yeah, I mean, with Republicans still solidly in control of the Senate, they control the scheduling for the Judiciary Committee, and they control what action, what business is conducted on the floor. There's no way really to force them to have a hearing or have a vote on him. And, you know, as we've seen, they can't really shame them into it either, I guess, because they've made up their minds.
Mm. Well, the other funny thing about it is they've also suggested that if Hillary Clinton is elected, then they'll go ahead in lame duck session and confirm him then. They just seem to be conflicting all over the place on this.
Mm. Well, and they've already made up their minds also, according to Robert Gerke here. Lee Davidson, I'd like to bring you into this. I know that I'm curious if we have if there was a change between what Senator Hatch wrote in advance and had published before he had the meeting with Garland and then what ended up in the Deseret News. Have you followed this?
Very little from what I can tell. He did mention that they had talked about their families. That was one of the few additions. Also, Hatch's press secretary issued a statement after the meeting that was almost word for word what the draft was. So he didn't change his mind very much.
All right. Well, again, he could change his mind after the election, as we've been saying, and maybe we'll see a new endorsement at that time. And I guess we'll have to wait and see. On the topic of endorsements, Robert Gerke, Utah Republican candidate for Governor Jonathan Johnson, picked up an interesting endorsement this week. Tell us about Freedom Works for America.
So Freedom Works is a Tea Party group that was founded by former Representative Dick Armey. They work nationally on sort of the typical small government, conservative, Tea Party issues. They've been players in Utah in past in political races. They were were early supporters of Senator Mike Lee when he was running against Bob Bennett. They came in and spent a lot of money opposing Representative Jim Matheson and trying to both. I think when he ran against Morgan Philpott and when he ran against Mia Love the first time. And they spent, I think it was $1.4 million opposing Senator Hatch when he ran for re-election. So they've been active in Utah. This week, they came in and endorsed Jonathan Johnson and his campaign against Governor Herbert. They said Herbert has raised taxes. He's supported Medicaid expansion, you know, like an expansion of Obamacare, and he's soft on pushing back against federal mandates on Common Core and SAGE testing. And so they're endorsing Jonathan Johnson. They're not pledging to put any money into the race this time, which is different than in those past races. They say they're going to rally their 25,000 members that they have in Utah to go out and vote on June 28th in the primaries and vote for Jonathan Johnson. Hard to say right now how much impact that's going to have. You would have to figure that those 25,000 people are probably pretty politically motivated anyway, and probably already in the Jonathan Johnson camp. But and Governor Herbert and his campaign shot back at FreedomWorks and said, well, you know, this is an outside group that's coming in and trying to tell Utah voters, you know, meddling in Utah's elections, when Orrin Hatch was running. Dave Hansen, who was Hatch's campaign manager at the time, said that he wishes they'd get the hell out for FreedomWorks when they were spending all this money in here. He characterized them as an outside group and Washington D.C. group, and so there is sort of that sort of outsider perspective. At least that's how both Dave Hansen tried to cast it when he was running Hatch's campaign. Now he's running Jonathan Johnson's campaign. It's a different story. Again, the Herbert campaign said that Jonathan and bringing FreedomWorks in is turning to Washington solutions and Washington values, which is what he's vowed not to do. And so anyway, this governor's race is kind of heating up. They're going at it pretty fast and furious.
Okay, well, so maybe not the Tea Party surge of 2010, but an endorsement that might make a difference. And you mentioned this veteran local political operative Dave Hansen and his having has he made a statement about this? And I know that Johnson himself has kind of accepted the endorsement. As you said, Herbert's campaign fired back. Has Dave Hansen said anything?
Well, he says he doesn't really see the problem. They align on the principles, he says, and that they, you know, it doesn't really give him much heartburn. I mean, they were a thorn in the side of the Hatch campaign, and Dave Hansen took numerous shots at them when he was running the Hatch campaign. So yeah, this is politics, right? This is the way it works. And you're my friend from 4 years ago, maybe my enemy today, and vice versa, it turns out. It's unclear how much of an actual impact this will have. But as I mentioned, the race is kind of heating up. The Johnson campaign's up on the air with some ads taking shots at Herbert for his available Jones comment that we discussed last week, where he said he's willing to go out and meet with lobbyists, hitting him again for raising taxes and so forth. The Herbert campaign has questioned the fundraising practices of Jonathan Johnson, and Jonathan has accepted over $600,000 from Patrick Byrne, who's the president of Overstock. They question, well, for that kind of money, which from what we've been able to find so far, appears to be the largest single political contribution to a candidate in Utah history. For that kind of money, what's Patrick expecting? They're essentially casting Jonathan Johnson as Patrick Byrne's puppet. They're like, you can choose how you raise your money, I guess. And the Governor Herbert is trying to raise money from a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But Jonathan Johnson is, as governor, the governor himself referred to it as sugar daddy, who is going to bankroll his entire campaign.
Are there any debates lined up between these candidates yet?
Well, the Johnson campaign has been clamoring for debates, and the challenger, straight out of the political playbook. The challenger always wants to have debates. The incumbent doesn't want to have debates if they're leading, and so there haven't been debates scheduled. Jonathan Johnson's supporters actually took to Facebook with sort of a cheeky idea of holding a bake sale to raise money to pay Herbert to come and hold a debate. Jonathan Johnson has been very vocal in saying that, you know, the governor has said he's available, Jones. He's available to meet with donors anywhere, anytime, but he's not available to meet to debate the issues. The 18 rural county Republican chair people have written a letter saying that they want to have a debate specifically on rural issues. And so far, the Herbert campaign has not scheduled those. I do think that there will be debates, and I think they'll probably have to happen fairly soon because June 6th is when ballots go out into the mail. I think 18 counties are doing vote by mail this year. Is that what you were? 20 counties are doing vote by mail this year, and so you know these mail-in ballots are going to have a big impact. But people are going to start voting within a matter of a couple weeks.
So not a lot of time for a debate. Well, lots of interesting political coverage that you can find at sltrib.com. In the meantime, if you've got a question or a comment yourself, call us up at 801-355-TALK or tweet your comments to the hashtag TribTalk. I'd actually like to turn now to a story having to do with the Utah Transit Authority. And Lee Davidson, this is something that you've been covering. UTA recently made a change to policy and said it would conduct its subcommittee meetings out of the public eye. There was then this backlash. That decision got reversed. It sounds like maybe, I don't know, a little bit of a PR problem for the transit agency. What happened here? And, you know, were there second thoughts on this policy change and why?
Well, it was a PR problem for them. They said they were making changes to increase transparency and public participation. But amid those changes, they announced that their committee meetings, where they did a lot of the in-depth work on issues, would be closed. They said those committees would no longer make final decisions, that only the full board would, and because of that, they thought the committee should be closed. Led to a lot of backlash. Governor Herbert and Jonathan Johnson spoke out against that, as did State Auditor John Dougal and many legislators. First Amendment lawyers said that UTA's interpretation of the open meetings law was incorrect, that those committee meetings were advisory and should be open. And then in a hallway interview with the board chairman, his name's H. David Burton, we asked him, well, why are you closing these meetings? And he said, you want to know the truth? It's because you screw us up, talking about the Tribune. And he made clear that those meetings had been closed because they didn't like the Tribune coverage of them, which didn't help their case at all. And what I think really got their attention was that the Salt Lake County Council, led by Richard Snellgrove, a member, threatened to cut off its collection of sales taxes for UTA, which could hurt to the tune of $150 million a year unless they open these meetings. The Utah County Commission also passed a resolution calling for these meetings to be open. And amid all of that kind of pressure on Tuesday, David Burton released a statement saying, okay, the meetings are going to be open, and we're going to continue to try to refine our processes to make them more transparent.
And they have had a kind of new commitment to transparency, right? They have a pledge to be very transparent. Is that accurate?
Yes. They say they're doing a lot of reform to try to overcome bad publicity in the past and to tell people that they can trust them, essentially. UTA can't raise its own taxes. It has to go to the people and ask them to do that. It did so last year in Proposition 1 that in part would have raised taxes for roads, but in part for UTA. Mm-hmm. Three counties passed it in their district. Three did not, including Salt Lake County and Utah County. And most people say it was because they didn't trust UTA, and even some UTA leaders acknowledge that. And so Burton and others have been trying a lot of reforms. Some people who had big salaries in the past are gone.
Right.
They've hired newer people at lower salaries or are looking for new people. They said that the change in their board meetings would help transparency.
Right. Well, on that point, I mean, this was a change in board meetings would help transparency, and the idea was to give the public greater input onto how things or into how things are done. But that's not exactly how things played out in a recent board meeting. Tell us what happened with the new service plan.
On Wednesday,
yeah.
This was the first meeting where they had posted their agenda far in advance and put background materials online, and people could comment online if they chose.
Mm-hmm.
The board was told that no one chose to comment online. The board ended up passing a new plan on how it will comply with federal mandates to ensure that minority and low-income areas are served properly.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a couple of groups and folk who have serious questions about the data used for that, who were trying to comment but didn't do it before the board voted. One of them was named Bill Tibbetts. He's the associate director of the Crossroads Urban Center that advocates for the poor. He had tried to send a letter via Twitter, or tried to tweet it to him,
mm-hmm.
and UTA, he said, told them that they don't accept it in that manner. And so he went to the board meeting in person. The agenda had projected times when they would discuss different issues, but the board went a little faster than expected, and Tibbetts didn't get there before they discussed this. They let him talk later in the meeting, listen politely, but did not change their vote nor discuss what he brought up. Some of the things he said was UTA considers a minority area to be anywhere where at least 21% of the residents are minorities. He said the problem is that included all of downtown Salt Lake City. And downtown Salt Lake City has the best transit service in the state. And when you include that, areas with truly high minority populations like Glendale, with 70% minority, it makes it sound like it's all wonderful. And he says it's not.
Skewing the results.
He says it skews the results, and you need to look at that. Meanwhile, there was another man who's a Salt Lake City school board member named Michael Clara, who sent the board a letter also complaining that the area he lives in is 70% minority, but UTA maps claim that it was not a minority area at all, which he said further skewed it. He did not submit that on time. UTA has a deadline to submit such things by Monday at 9 a.m. before their Wednesday afternoon meeting. Clarida didn't email that, apparently, until the meeting was in process. He had copied me on it, so I saw the email. But UTA said, you know, these folks didn't meet our deadlines. They did hear one discussion, but they didn't change it. So it was kind of passing this plan before they heard discussion about it. So it's a little hiccup in the transparency process.
And
it's first time ever.
And for the next board meeting, I guess we'll see how things progress in terms of whether or not these hiccups get resolved. It's also an interesting story. A lot of great coverage on UTA at sltrib.com. Again, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 801-355-TALK, if you've got a question or comment. You can also tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Thanks very much, Lee Davidson. Health, education, and environment reporter Emma Penrod, you've been very patient here. Thanks for being here. I'd like to turn now to a story that you reported on this week, that a group of Arizona business owners are upset that air pollution coming from Utah is affecting, I guess, visibility at the Grand Canyon. First off, where is this air pollution coming from?
Yeah, this is the pollution that they are complaining about is coming from two power plants in central eastern Utah. These are the Hunter and Huntington power plants. They are operated by Rocky Mountain Power, and they are key factors in Utah's implementation plan for the regional haze rule.
And then who are these business owners, and what do they want to see done to address this?
Well, they're primarily they own outdoors related businesses. Some are manufacturers. There's an outfitter I spoke to. There's about 50 of them, mostly from around the Grand Canyon area. They feel, you know, there have been two plans proposed by the EPA for public comment. One is to say, let's use the state's plan, which takes into account the closure of a third power plant, and says, we're good. We don't need to do any further action to meet the requirements of the regional haze rule.
We've already cut out a big chunk of pollution by closing down this one plant. Okay.
Yes, that's what they're arguing. Then the EPA has released another plan. Both are alternatives being proposed by the EPA. It hasn't decided which alternative it likes. The other alternative is, okay, but we need to add an additional requirement of this specific pollution control technology at Hunter and Huntington, because you can't quite claim the closure of a power plant that closed for extraneous reasons.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a decision you took. It happened to close, and now you're trying to take credit for it.
And there's a lot of argument as to, you know, was it because the state that the plant closed in? Yeah. But these are the two alternatives.
And how do state regulators feel about these two alternatives and what should be done? I guess the state is arguing that they've already done what they need to do.
The state argues that they have already met the requirements, and they argue that the EPA's plan would be very costly and would result in minimal improvements to visibility because of some atmospheric conditions in the area.
And is there, does the EPA counter that? Do they say that this actually would have an effect on visibility?
The EPA believes it would have a pronounced impact on visibility.
Okay, and you would think that with the state receiving this, I recognize that the Grand Canyon is outside of our state, but the state does receive a fair amount of money from tourism, according to a recent report, that air quality around national parks has to be a concern of some level to organizations, but also to residents who live in the area, businesses like these businesses that are coming together to try and get changes made.
Well, there may be some consideration of that, but this particular issue is related to what's effectively a federal regulation, this regional haze rule, which requires the restoration of natural visibility at all protected areas, national parks, such like that, by the year 2064. And the states are required to comply with that rule and create plans for how they're going to accomplish that. So this is, although it is about air quality, it's also largely a legal issue, that there would be consequences potentially for the state if they don't comply with this rule.
Well, and you pointed out that you reported that Bryce Bird, who is director of the Utah Division of Air Quality, said that the state is kind of looking long term with this 2064 compliance deadline, that they are actually on track to meet these requirements. Is that correct?
Yes, the state their state's current figures show that Utah is on track to meet that deadline. I don't think the debate is about progress to date. The state argues, let's just keep making this measured progress. We're good to go. Environmentalists have said, but we could make more progress now. Why should we wait?
And so the EPA is in the meantime considering these two competing plans to address haze around the area. What is there? What's the deadline on that? And is there an input for public, or a place for the public to add their comments?
Well, the public comment period is closed at this point.
Okay.
The EPA has been sued for having failed to review this plan in a timely manner. And as per a legal settlement, they must make a decision by June 1st regarding which plan they're going to go with.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting reporting. Also at sltrib.com. Emma, another your articles this week was on Governor Gary Herbert's Energy Summit. It's a related story. Some protests of that event by environmentalists. What were the protesters' complaints?
Yeah, so there was one protest, and they kind of kicked off the summit by meeting an hour before the first session. And they were meeting to ask the governor to reinstate the state's implementation planning process for another federal regulation, the Clean Power Plan. That was cut off in February.
And that's a plan that's being challenged also in the courts by a number of states, including Utah.
Yeah, Utah and about two dozen other states have sued, saying, you know, challenging that the rule is constitutional. The Supreme Court has, I believe, said they're going to hear it later this year.
Okay. What would the Clean Power Plan do or require states to do?
The Clean Power Plan is related to President Obama's initiatives to cut the U.S.'s carbon footprint. So it requires the reduction of emissions, especially carbon emissions, from power plants. And again, the states are required to decide exactly how they will meet the goals set in the Clean Power Plan. So that's why the state was then beginning the process for an implementation plan to decide how it was going to go about doing this. then in February, the governor said, you know what, we don't actually know whether we're even going to be required to make this plan. The Supreme Court has issued a stay. There is no deadline as long as that stay exists. So we're not going to plan for this.
We're going to back off. So we're going to stop the process going forward from trying to make this.
They had already held, I believe, one meeting with stakeholders to begin discussions there, and then, you know, there was an announcement that came out in February, and they ended it.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about what the Governor's Energy Summit is meant to do. This is a yearly summit, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it gathers together people from a variety of industries, or what describe that for us.
Yeah, it's just kind of a broad meeting of energy industry and energy related industries in Utah. There's a trade show. There was this year a exhibit of electric cars. Mm. There was discussion of new technologies to prevent air pollution. There was discussion of what are we going to do about falling gas prices. There was, you know, it's really a very broad kind of a thing. Just anything. There was a seminar on water as it was related to energy production.
And one of the complaints of protesters was that this clean power plan wasn't being talked about enough during this summit.
Yeah, they said that last year the clean power plan was a key topic that was addressed at the summit, and that this year there was no discussion at all. It didn't ultimately come up in one particular session, but it wasn't necessarily on the agenda. It was brought up by a panelist. Hmm. So they felt that now is the time, as others have said with the regional haze rule, they feel now is the time to begin to address this problem rather than later.
Rather than waiting. Well, we're going to shortly have to take our final break before we come back for our underplayed story of the week. But before we do that, actually, Paul Raleigh, we're talking environment with Emma Penrod here, and you also covered an environment-related story that having to do with fake flyers and letters in San Juan County aimed at, I guess, intimidating, maybe scaring American Indians in the region. What was this about?
Well, there were flyers that popped up in the bulletin board of the post office in Bluff and then some other areas around San Juan County. It was supposedly a press release from the Department of Interior saying that they were going to drastically reduce the lands of the Navajo Reservation. It was a complete fabrication, but it caused a stir. And then it was also accompanied by a flyer that was inviting everybody to a party in June to celebrate the creation of the Bearer's Ears National Monument, and everybody was invited except Utah Navajos because Utah Navajos were not had not been supportive enough, and the whole idea was to split the community down there. By all accounts, the Bearer's Ears has enormous support, particularly among the Native American population. And it was just kind of a dirty trick to try and create some kind of animosity toward the Bearer's Ears. It was done anonymously.
I was going to say, do we know who did this?
Well, we don't. I pointed out in my story that a lot of the comment. There was also a phony letter that supposedly went out from a Navajo, a tribal board member on one of the districts, saying that there were tribal leaders who were making a lot of money off this, you know, individually, which also was not true. But a lot of these things were very similar to what has been said in political circles by those who are opposing the Bearer's Ears at the legislature and congressional delegation.
It's a big topic to try and open up at the very end of the show here, but really interesting reporting in your column there. Check it out at sltrib.com. We are going to have to take a quick break, but when we return in a moment, we'll go to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Donald Trump gets the delegates to officially become the presumptive GOP nominee. Meanwhile, the fight on the Democratic side continues, with Bernie Sanders calling for a closer look at the results out of Kentucky and a State Department report critical of Clinton's use of an outside email server. We'll look at the week in the 2016 campaign next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio would like to congratulate Nadra Hafar, education curator in the Utah State University Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art, for receiving a certification from the Utah Division of Arts and Museums. Hafar is now certified with the Change Leader Institute, which works to help advance communities through art and culture. Kudos from Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and it is time now for our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week, stories that maybe didn't get covered quite to the extent that they ought to. And Emma Penrob, what have you got for your underplayed story this week?
Yeah, so I have a story here by my coworker, Brian Mathley. Some research has come out, found that there was once a gigantic landslide in Zion National Park that cut off the flow of the Virgin River for some time and allowed the sediment to build up behind it and create the flat floors in Zion National Park. So if you're a science nerd like me, that's pretty fun to see how some of this stuff worked.
Massive collapse of a structure there in Zion. All right, Paul Raleigh, how about you? What's your pick for your underplayed story?
Well, I actually changed mine based on a discussion we had earlier in the program, and that we were talking about Dave Hansen and the different sides he had to take when he was campaign manager for Orrin Hatch and now Jonathan Johnson. I remember when it came out that he was going to be Jonathan Johnson's campaign manager, I talked to him because he had been a supporter of Governor Herbert before. And he said one of the reasons he was doing that is that he was for term limits and you know, Herbert had been in long enough. And it was pointed out by many people that he also was the campaign manager for Orrin Hatch, who's been in the Senate since 1977.
All right. All right, Paul Raleigh, how about you, Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week?
Well, I was going to go with the guy who was arrested for having bells tied around his naughty bits up at the Spanish Fork Canyon. But if you haven't read it yet, check out Ben Wood's reporting on charter school funding and who makes money on those and who it is that profits from contracting and running these charter schools. It's great. It's great work.
All right. And Lee Davidson.
Took a story about how times are changing. At Salt Lake International Airport, taxis have lost 25% of their business to Uber and Lyft since last September when those ride-hailing services began to operate legally out there. I found my bosses were amazed that they lost that much, but actually I was amazed that they hadn't lost more.
Right.
So.
Right, and well, it's competition, I guess. For my part, I'm going to go with a sports story. Golden State Warriors had a rough start in the Western Conference Finals against the Thunder, but yesterday they won and lived to fight another day. Not underplayed at all, but Steph Curry's a bit of a basketball wizard. Game 6 on Saturday. Lee Davidson, Robert Gerke, Paul Raleigh, Emma Penrod, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy Memorial Day.
Thanks a lot.
That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and the Tribune's Emily Means. Much more on all of the stories we covered today at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll explore some of the fascinating music of the vast and varied country of India. And we'll also hear the music of South Asians living in other countries around the world. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Flavors of India, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us tonight at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.